From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with novelist Jeffrey Eugenides, author of The Virgin Suicides. His new novel, Middlesex, is about a contemporary hermaphrodite. The narrator of the story starts life as a female, but at the onset of puberty, her body becomes increasingly masculine, so she decides to live as a male. Also, poet Sharon Olds reads from her new collection, The Unswept Room, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Home, the new CD by the Dixie Chicks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has presented a report to Parliament on Iraq's weapons programs. He says Saddam Hussein presents a danger to the region and must be disarmed. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from London.
Tony Blair presented the 55-page report before an emergency session of Parliament to rally opinion behind a possible military strike.
And if people say, why should Britain care? I answer, because there is no way that this man, in this region above all regions, could begin a conflict using such weapons and the consequences not engulf the whole world, including this country.
Experts who read the report said its allegations about chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons programs contained little new evidence. But Blair needs evidence to change a skeptical public opinion. Last night, he had to summon his cabinet to silence members who questioned the legality and humanitarian consequences of a U.S.-led attack. Many MPs from Blair's own Labour Party have also expressed doubts. Nick Spicer, NPR News, London.
Senate leaders say they're working toward a compromise with the Bush administration on a resolution supporting the use of force against Iraq. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said many senators are supportive of a multilateral approach toward Iraq. Daschle said he's hopeful that the Senate and the White House can reach agreement on some changes in the language of the resolution by the end of this week. Senate Republican Leader Trent Lott said he thinks President Bush will be willing to consider some changes to the resolution. The Bush administration says the threat of a terrorist attack in the United States has been lowered to code yellow on the nationwide terror alert chart. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
2 weeks ago, just prior to the anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the administration increased the terror threat one level to code orange. That's classified as a high risk of attack. It's the second highest level on the color-coded system. Now the president has authorized that the alert level be reduced one step to yellow. That's right in the middle of the five-step chart and is described as an elevated risk. White House officials stress that Americans still need to be aware and mindful that a terrorist threat still exists, and that the status of the alert is evaluated on a day-to-day basis. The reason the warning level has been reduced, officials say, is because of what is described as recent disruptions in the al-Qaeda terrorist network. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A pall of smoke hung over the Los Angeles area today as firefighters battled a blaze in the nearby San Gabriel Mountains. Officials say the smoke from the Williams Fire is being trapped in the Los Angeles basin by an unusually strong inversion layer. The L.A. County Health Department issued an extreme caution advisory because of the pollution, warning people to avoid unnecessary outdoor activity. In stocks today, the Dow lost 189 points to close at 7,683. The Nasdaq lost 2 to close at 1,182. This is NPR News. Terrorists attacked a Hindu temple in western India today, killing at least 29 people and wounding more than 40. Commandos have surrounded the main building in the temple complex, where the attackers are reported to be holding them off with hand grenades and automatic rifles. The attack took place in Gujarat state, where about 1,000 people were killed earlier this year in violence between Hindus and Muslims. A study finds HMO report cards are not as reliable as they could be. The study is published in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
Researchers from Harvard University examined performance reports over a 3-year period. These report cards are done by a nonprofit private organization which asks HMOs to submit information about how they care for patients. That includes how they screen for disease and how they treat chronic illnesses like diabetes. The HMOs are then graded and results are usually made public, but researchers found that HMOs that were poorly rated in 1 year were far more likely than other HMOs to stop disclosing results the following year. The organization that rates HMOs recently began requiring the health plans to be surveyed with results made public in order to be accredited. Most employers will only contract with HMOs that are accredited. Patricia Namond, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Xerox said today that federal prosecutors have begun a new investigation of the company's accounting practices. Earlier this year, Xerox paid $10 million to the Securities and Exchange Commission to settle charges that it falsely manipulated its financial results. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, maker of sustainably sourced hair, body, and lifestyle products and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at Aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest Jeffrey Eugenides as the author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into a film. His second novel has just been published. It's called Middlesex. The narrator of the story was born in 1960 and starts life as a girl named Callie. But as she approaches puberty, she realizes that she isn't like other girls. Eventually, she discovers that she was born a hermaphrodite, and she is becoming more physically masculine with age. In her early teens, she abandons her identity as a woman and changes her name from Callie to Cal and begins to live as a man. The novel also covers the two preceding generations of the narrator's family, starting with his Greek immigrant parents. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani writes, "The novel turns the story of Cal's coming of age into an uproarious epic, at once funny and sad, about misplaced identities and family secrets." Eugenides has delivered a deeply affecting portrait of one family's tumultuous engagement with the American 20th century. Let's start with a reading from Middlesex.
I was born twice. First as a baby girl on a remarkably smogless Detroit day in January of 1960, and then again as a teenage boy in an emergency room near Petoskey, Michigan, in August of 1974. Specialized readers may have come across me in Dr. Peter Luce's study, Gender Identity and 5 Alpha Reductase Pseudohermaphrodites, published in the Journal of Pediatric Endocrinology in 1975. Or maybe you've seen my photograph in Chapter 16 of the now sadly outdated Genetics and Heredity. That's me on page 578, standing naked beside a height chart, with a black box covering my eyes. My birth certificate lists my name as Calliope Helen Stefanides. My most recent driver's license from the Federal Republic of Germany records my first name simply as Cal. I'm a former field hockey goalie, long-standing member of the Save the Manatee Foundation, rare attendant at the Greek Orthodox liturgy, and, for most of my adult life, an employee of the U.S. State Department. Like Tiresias, I was first one thing and then the other. I've been ridiculed by classmates, guinea-pigged by doctors, palpated by specialists, and researched by the March of Dimes. A red-headed girl from Grosse Pointe fell in love with me, not knowing what I was. Her brother liked me, too. An army tank led me into urban battle once. A swimming pool turned me into myth. I've left my body in order to occupy others. And all this happened before I turned 16.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides reading the beginning of his new novel, Middlesex. Jeffrey, why did you want to write about a contemporary hermaphrodite?
Well, the first kernel of the idea came to me when I read an actual memoir of a 19th century hermaphrodite that Michel Foucault found in the archives of the French Public Department of Hygiene. And I thought this would be a very interesting book and went and read it and was filled with frustration because the hermaphrodite in question, Herculine Barbin, was a convent school girl, or at least in her early years. And when she came to write the story of her life, she wrote very much like a convent school girl. I actually brought the diary with me in case you wanted to hear some of it. But
oh, yeah, you bet. Why don't you read a few lines from it?
I will. This is midway through her memoirs when she has fallen in love with her best friend at the convent school, and this is the first night they spend together. Happy about this pretext, which was only too true, one evening I asked my friend to share my bed. She accepted with pleasure. It would be impossible to express the happiness I felt from her presence at my side. I was wild with joy. We talked for a long time before going to sleep, I with my arms encircling her waist, she with her face resting near my own. My God, was I guilty? And must I accuse myself here of a crime? No, no. That fault was not mine. It was the fault of an unexampled fatality, which I could not resist. 3 exclamation points. Henceforth, Sarah belonged to me. 2 exclamation points. She was mine. 3 exclamation points. It sort of goes on in that fashion. And I was just terribly frustrated because she was evasive about her story and all of the things I wanted to know about a hermaphrodite's life. She was unable to tell me. And I got the idea of writing my own story. And in contrast with the way most hermaphrodites in literature have been handled, usually as mythical creatures or as fanciful creations like Orlando and Virginia Woolf, I wanted to write a story about a real-life hermaphrodite and be accurate as possible as I could about the medical facts and the biological circumstances.
What's the medical explanation for your main character's condition?
Well, it's a very rare genetic mutation, and the condition is called 5-alpha reductase deficiency syndrome. And it occurs in very isolated communities. What it basically is, if you inherit this mutation, your body is unable to respond to certain androgens or male hormones for a long time. So as you're formed in the womb, you would have an XY chromosome, you would be male, and you would be born looking very, very much like a girl, almost undetectably so. And at puberty, as testosterone gets stronger in your blood, you would then virilize and become quite masculine in appearance. So it's one of the most dramatic hermaphroditic conditions that exists, and that's one of the reasons it appealed to me. But in that it was usually occurring only in inbred communities and isolated communities, I then saw a chance to make this story, broaden this story from a fictional memoir of a hermaphrodite to a story about an entire family, a Greek-American family in this case, and the transmission of this gene down through the generations until it finally is inherited by the narrator and flowers in her body, and later as a man she tells the story.
And since this genetic condition happens in inbred populations, you have this character's grandparents being not only husband and wife, but also brother and sister. And the character's parents are not only husband and wife, but also second cousins. Why did you want to explore that kind of familial, marital relationship?
Well, the inbreeding was demanded by the genetic condition I was using. And to bring in mythology again, of course... Zeus and Hera, I believe, are brother and sister in Greek mythology. And so I was playing with some of these ideas, ancient ideas in literature. I needed to dramatize inbreeding. And inbreeding is actually quite boring. It takes generations and generations and centuries. And so in order to dramatize that, it required me to speed up the process and to actually have grandparents be siblings. It seemed to me to be the best way to dramatize, you know, what was going on at a cellular level.
Jeffrey Eugenides is my guest. He's the author of the book The Virgin Suicides. Now he has a new novel called Middlesex about a hermaphrodite. Now, in the beginning of your book Middlesex, the narrator explains that he was born as a girl and reborn as a teenage boy in an emergency room at the age of 14. What happens in the emergency room?
Well, in the emergency room is the first time when someone other than Callie sees her anatomy in bright light. At that point, Callie is 14. She still looks like a girl, though a flat-chested one. But after an accident, she's taken to the emergency room, and in undressing her to see if she has any broken bones, the doctor does see her genitals, which at that point would be not characteristic or entirely characteristic of a girl of her age.
And why does your character decide to be a boy?
Well, it's a long process and a difficult one for her. The condition that she has, of course, is so virilizing that after she goes through puberty, she would basically have musculature, facial hair, and a deep voice, and would appear to be male. So it would be easier at least to operate in society as a male. And Cal, as he talks about his life in Berlin as an adult, he's careful to say that he operates in society as a male. It's not clear whether he considers himself a regular man or a regular guy, but it is the way that he most easily can get along.
He seems to have a consciousness of what he is, which is something that's strictly neither 100% male nor 100% female.
Right. But I think in terms of the book itself, because Callie falls in love with her best friend, that did provide a certain impetus for her decision to be a boy. But then, of course, when she goes to the gender identity clinic, she does find out about her chromosomal status being XY, and that is another reason why she finally decides to adopt a male gender identity.
When she decides to adopt a male gender identity, she has to learn the outward characteristics of men. I want you to read a paragraph. This is on page 449, in which your main character describes that kind of transformation of learning to walk and talk like a male.
Like a convert to a new religion, I overdid it at first. Somewhere near Gary, Indiana, I adopted a swagger. I rarely smiled. My expression throughout Illinois was the Clint Eastwood squint. It was all bluff, but so was it on most men. We were all walking around squinting at each other. My swagger wasn't that different from what lots of adolescent boys put on, trying to be manly. For that reason, it was convincing. Its very falseness made it credible. Now and then I fell out of character. Feeling something stuck to the bottom of my shoe, I kicked up my heel and looked back over my shoulder to see what it was, rather than crossing my leg in front of me and twisting up my shoe. I picked correct change from my open palm instead of my trouser pocket. Such slips made me panic, but needlessly. No one noticed. I was aided by that. As a rule, people don't notice much.
I wonder if when you wrote that, you thought back to your own puberty and when you were going through the process of turning into a man from having been a boy, and if you felt that you were acting in a way, acting the role of man.
This continues to be something that I feel like I do. In order to get those characteristics that I thought were more common amongst females than males, I didn't think back to my early years. I actually walked around my room trying to imagine how do girls usually look at things when they're stuck to their shoe? How do they count change? And it actually took me a long time to come up with just those few examples that seemed to me evidently female or male.
My guest is Jeffrey Eugenides. He has a new novel called Middlesex. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Eugenides. We're talking about his new novel, Middlesex. For your novel, Middlesex, you've really mastered a lot of the medical language of the contemporary hermaphrodite. You know a lot about the intersex support groups. What kind of research did you do so that you would have both a medical and social understanding of what hermaphrodites might be going through today?
Well, the debate right now in terms of intersex people and in terms of sexual reconfiguration surgery is between the pediatric endocrinologists and the hermaphrodites or the intersex community. So I basically read texts from both sides of that debate. I read a lot of sexology. I read books by John Money, who's the leading theoretician in the sexology field, or has been. And I read a lot of things published by the Intersex Society of North America, based out in San Francisco, and corresponded briefly with the executive director of that organization. And they have a newsletter that is called Hermaphrodites with Attitude, and they also publish other books and writings by hermaphrodites. So I read all of those. I watched videos that they offer about hermaphrodites telling their own stories. And I left it at that. I didn't interview intersex people, and I didn't go on the road to visit their demonstrations. I tried to acquire the knowledge through reading what they had to say and then imagining the rest myself.
Why didn't you want to go to the demonstrations or meet any intersex people?
I just don't usually work in the entirely repertorial mode. Mm-hmm. I need a certain amount of information, but I work largely through my imagination and through a sort of method acting where I try to imagine, if I put myself into this situation, how would I have reacted? And that way I hope that the story seems more believable. And I don't try to look at another person and try to imagine what it's like for them. If I had been a hermaphrodite, this is what I would have been like. And it may not be the way other intersex people are, but it certainly is the way that this character would have been. Because I also don't believe that there is any one experience that would be the intersex or hermaphrodite experience. There would be just as many as any other population, just as various.
At the same time you were reading the sexology literature and the intersex literature, were you also reading ancient Greek literature?
I didn't read a lot of ancient Greek literature while writing Middlesex, but I took 7 years of Latin. I started studying Latin in seventh grade, and this influenced my writing quite a bit. In fact, I was just thinking the other day, in 10th grade, our Latin teacher had us read Ovid's Metamorphosis, and we were reading about the argument between Zeus and Hera, and the argument was about who had the most pleasure in the act of love, men or women. Zeus said men did, Hera said women did. And they argue, and then they decide, well, let's ask Tiresias. Tiresias was both a man and a woman. Tiresias is brought in and says, women enjoy the greater part of pleasure in lovemaking. As you can imagine, this was of great interest to the young Latin scholar that I was in 10th grade, and probably, in a way, started me thinking about Tiresias, hermaphrodites, and the whole issue of what it would be like if you were a person who could experience both realms.
While we're talking about gender, which is the subject that you write about both in The Virgin Suicides and in your new novel, Middlesex, I'm wondering if when you were growing up there were aspects of masculinity you felt you didn't fit into, and if there were things about being female that particularly interested you, that you particularly would have liked to either experience or understand more.
I mean, actually, I've always been quite happy in my gender. I was very interested in sports as a boy, and the only thing that I did that was not terribly masculine was that I had a great interest in theater. And when you are acting and in theater, you are in some ways going away from the normal route of young boys. But I don't remember wanting to do things the girls did or anything like that. In fact, when I was about 12 or 13, I had very long hair and was sometimes mistaken for a girl. If I were with a group of girls, a mother would come out and she would say, would you girls like some Kool-Aid? And I would absolutely be horrified by this. So I was pretty Midwestern in wanting to be a boy and pretty happy with that.
You've been living in Berlin for at least a couple of years. How long has it been?
We're starting our fourth year. We've been here 3 years, which is much longer than we ever thought. We were originally coming just for 1 year on a grant, but we've liked the city, and so we've stayed on.
And, you know, at this time when you've been writing a lot about the history of immigrants in America and what mm-hmm. gender is like in America, mm-hmm. you've actually been living far from America in Berlin. And I'm wondering if you feel like you've been living in an environment in which gender expectations are slightly different than in the United States.
Well, one thing I first have to say about the experience of living in Berlin, there's a story in my family about my grandparents. When they first came to the United States, my grandfather had to do all the shopping because he could speak English and my grandmother couldn't, and she was frightened of the stores. And so he basically was the public face for the family. He would talk to anyone on the phone, he would do the shopping, he would deal with salesmen and things like that. And because I started my German a little bit before Karen, my wife, did, for the first years in Berlin, I was also this immigrant who could half speak the language and had to do all of those things. So when I was writing about my grandparents in Detroit and getting used to Detroit, I was actually in a similar experience as a immigrant or as a foreigner in Germany.
I would imagine one of the most frustrating things about that is that when you can't speak the language of a country, a lot of people just assume that you're not very smart.
That you're dumb.
Because you can't articulate what you're thinking or even
yes.
what you want to buy in the grocery store.
Yes, and a fact about Berlin that might not be known is that Berliners are the rudest people on the planet. They make New Yorkers seem like they have Southern charm. And if you don't speak properly and if you dawdle, you will receive a tongue lashing that you can't imagine.
Or that you can't understand either if you don't speak the language.
You can get the gist of it, believe me.
Right. Well, Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of the new novel, Middlesex. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, linking midweek travelers with the annual fall colors of Vermont. Online travel planner at vermontvacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, poet Sharon Olds reads from her new collection, The Unswept Room. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Home, the new CD by the Dixie Chicks, their first album since 1999. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, the poet Sharon Olds, has a new collection called The Unswept Room. She won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her 1983 collection, The Dead and the Living. She was New York State's Poet Laureate from 1998 to 2000, and she chairs NYU's Creative Writing Program. Critic Dwight Garner has said that her work's apparent simplicity can't hide the scalding honesty of her observations. Writer Michael Ondaatje has described her poems as pure fire in the hands. When I asked Sharon Olds if she thinks her new collection has a theme that holds it together, she said no, and then proceeded to describe what she did when she was putting the book together.
At the end of the putting it together, I did what I call my cliche round robin, which was to go through the whole book and see what words I was using over and over and over again and see if I could take any of them out so that it wasn't, I wasn't using the same words in a boring or a cliche way, in an inexact way. Some of the words I remember were like, as in similes, as if, God, love, gold, fire, soft, little, tiny, bright, flame, etc. But that's not really answering your question.
That's a great answer, though. I love the idea of a cliche round robin.
It's very fun. Oh, it was actually interesting to me to notice the words that did not change much. Love and sex and breast, I think those words didn't change a lot. I know that like and as if was very important to me because of thinking about similes and metaphors. But other words like small, little, tiny, bright changed a lot. So in a way, if they were intransigent to being fixed and made better, it made me think, okay, they intransigent, of course, in terms of my taste, my sense of what's okay, what looks okay. Then I figured, all right, I'm not going to fool with that. But if they were, if it was a word that easily changed, then I thought, right, this is a word I just use out of kind of to hold the place for a more exact word, maybe.
Why do you feel like you can't overuse words like and as if? They're the kind of words that a lot of us don't pay attention to. You know, it's as if blah blah blah. You just mm-hmm, say mm-hmm. it. Why do you have to be careful about those words?
When I'm doing my cliche round robin, if I find 50 or 60 as ifs in one book, I want to look at them mm-hmm. and I want to see if it's accurate for my sense of reality and truthfulness, and certainly like to say, oh, I don't know, the sea is like the sky. that could be true to me. But another poet might say, the sea is the sky. Not just a surreal poet, but a very imaginative poet willing to talk transformatively. I use almost no metaphors ever. I use almost only similes. This isn't on purpose. It's just something I've noticed that I do. I think it's accurate to my vision of things because the way I see things, a lot of things seem a lot like a lot of other things. And especially after my run-ins with religious imagination and hellfire Puritanism as a child, I don't want to say that something is something else if I don't think it really is. The struggle for realism in terms of, you know, blood being blood, wine being wine. I say that with respect for those who truly, and I kind of, you know, believe in transformative realities. But I'm in the work of trying to believe in what I can see and hear as real.
Well, we'll get back to this in a moment, but I want to hear a poem. There's a poem in your new collection, The Unswept Room, called The Wedding Vow. It's a poem about love in which I don't think you use the word love.
right.
Why don't you read the poem and then we'll talk about it.
The Wedding Vow. I did not stand at the altar. I stood at the foot of the chancel steps with my beloved, and the minister stood on the top step holding the open Bible. The church was wood, painted ivory inside, no people, God's stable, perfectly cleaned, It was night, spring. Outside, a mote of mud, and inside, from the rafters, flies fell onto the open Bible, and the minister tilted it and brushed them off. We stood beside each other, crying slightly with fear and awe. In truth, we had married that first night in bed. We had been married by our bodies, but now we stood in history. What our bodies had said, mouth to mouth, we now said publicly, gathered together, death. We stood holding each other by the hand, yet I also stood as if alone for a moment, just before the vow, though taken years before, took. It was a vow of the present and the future, and yet I felt it to have some touch on the distant past, or the distant past on it. I felt the silent, dry, crying ghost of my parents' marriage there, somewhere in the bright space, perhaps one of the plummeting flies bouncing slightly as it hit, forsaking all others, then was brushed away. I felt as if I had come to claim a promise, the sweetness I'd inferred from their sourness, and at the same time that I had come congenitally unworthy to beg. And yet I had been working toward this hour all my life. And then it was time to speak. He was offering me, no matter what, his life. That is all I had to do that evening, to accept the gift I had longed for, to say I had accepted it, as if being asked if I breathe. Do I take? I do. I take as he takes. We have been practicing this. Do you bear this pleasure? I do.
Sharon Olds reading her poem, The Wedding Vow. It's collected in her new book, The Unswept Room. Now, before you read the poem, you were talking about your religious imagination, how your imagination was affected by your religious upbringing. What kind of upbringing was it? What was the religion you were brought up in?
Well, it was a kind of combination of Calvinism and Puritanism and Emily Postism, though God, neither God nor the devil seemed to have very good manners to me. It had to do with sin, guilt, being wicked, doing everything wrong, you know, kind of typical Protestant, but hellfire Protestant upbringing in my day.
As someone who's really sensitive to language, were there certain words that were used or certain stories that were told in church that had the deepest effect on you?
How interesting. Well, what comes into my mind is, I didn't hear it in church, but I heard it in my mind, roast like a marshmallow forever.
Hell?
Yeah. And for a child, you know, at summer camp, roasting a marshmallow, it's an awful sight to roast a marshmallow when you're a little Calvinist, you know, wicked child. I'm joking about it now, but it was not funny at the time.
My guest is the poet Sharon Olds. She has a new collection called The Unswept Room. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the poet Sharon Olds. She has a new collection of poems called The Unswept Room. There's a poem I'd like you to read from your new collection called Frosted Elfin. And this poem, to me anyways, I think that this poem is about how a woman might see her own body compared to how her lover might see it. And I'm wondering what got you thinking about this subject.
I wouldn't be surprised if the beautiful little moth that's called a frosted elfin moth may have first started the thinking in this poem, and then slipper conch is a beautiful little shell. So probably the excitement of the language of frosted elfin. What a word for a little moth, which had a pretty look, maybe something like a woman's body a little, and then a slipper conch also, that shell, very elegant, sweet shell. And so probably that's all I was thinking. I sure wasn't thinking about anything that comes up in the poem. I had no idea what was going to come up in the poem. The poems kind of, for me, come up on their own. Whatever's in them, I don't see before my pen puts it down.
Well, why don't you read it for us?
Thank you. Frosted Elfin. When I was a child, I could look down over my tummy and see myself, classic and symmetrical, like a slipper conch. If only I had a flower there now, the brown-purple fur of a pansy. My love sees a flower there, but I think of the hair, like hair that grows in the grave, or hair that could sprout all over the face of a daughter, as if the mother had made of her a weensy bearded husband, as if a child could catch hairiness like an illness from the mother's whiskered nether visage. When I close my eyes, I sense the entrance within me like the throat of a blossom. But when I picture it, I think of my mother. When I was in the tub and she took off her clothes, that complex mark, spear in the side and crown of thorns mashed together, lodged a sorrow and dread in me I had thought to take to the grave and grow a silver pubic beard like a sideways bridal veil falls. But my love says, it is sweet beyond sweetness, it is like an oasis. But I saw her from the tub, the bottom of the body like the bottom of the earth. But my love says, it is a wing, a pair of wings, wherein we fly to paradise and through it and to what lies beyond it. I want to be able to look with my own eyes and see what he sees. I will have to put my mother down a moment, just for one moment, Mom.
I like that poem a lot. And I think you've hit on something really interesting there about how a woman can be very self-conscious about her body or be first introduced to a woman's body by seeing her mother's naked body and then to realize how differently a lover might see that same body.
Mm-hmm. And I did actually have some thoughts while I was reading it. One was to see with one's own eyes, that whole idea I had been reading. Sharon Dubiago wrote an amazing essay about not only wanting to study the human body in its beauty and its livingness, but to understand all the anatomy. And I think she went even to some autopsy and saw how things were really put together. And I have this book, it's like Transparent Woman, Transparent Man, with veins running all over, up and down, and the bones and the shell and all the nerves with all their names. I love that book. And autopsos is from the Greek to see with one's own eyes. And I just kind of remembered that while I was reading it.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem that was written too recently to be included in your book. And it's a poem that you wrote referring to September 11th. But although this is a post-September 11th poem, it's a very personal poem that's not about how the world changed, but it's more about how your heart changed. The person in this poem finds that she's able to feel happy for her ex-husband, who's found a new lover. And in this poem, she also realizes what a privilege it was to be able to be at her elderly mother's bedside as she died. Let me ask you to read the poem, and then we'll talk about it. The poem is called A Week Later. Would you read it for us? And I should say this was first published in The Atlantic magazine.
A week later. A week later, I said to a friend, I don't think I could ever write about it. Maybe in a year I could write something. There is something in me, maybe someday, to be written. Now it is folded and folded and folded like a note in school. And in my dream, someone was playing jacks, and in the air there was a huge throne tilted jack on fire. And when I woke up, I found myself counting the days since I had last seen my husband, only 3 years and some weeks and hours. We had signed the papers and come down to the ground floor of the Chrysler Building, the intact beauty of its lobby around us like a king's tomb, on the ceiling the little painted plane in the mural flying. And it entered my strictured heart this morning, slightly, shyly, as if warily, untamed, a greater sense of the sweetness and plenty of his ongoing life, unknown to me, unseen by me, unheard by me, untouched by me, but known by others, seen by others, heard, touched. And it came to me, for moments at a time, moment after moment, to be glad for him that he is with the one he feels was meant for him. And I thought of my mother, minutes from her death, 85 years from her birth, the almost warbler bones of her shoulder under my hand, the eggshell skull, as she lay in some peace in the clean sheets, and I could tell her the best of my poor, partial love. I could sing her out with it. I saw the luck and luxury of that hour.
Sharon Olds reading her poem A Week Later. Have you been reading this poem much to audiences?
I have. I happened to get on a bunch of planes last September and October and November, my usual reading schedule, and I kind of started just reading mostly other people's poems that felt to me to have some, I just couldn't do anything else. You know, if I was going to go talk to kids in college, I wanted to take them something that would hopefully maybe help them. And then I would read mine and I would say, you know, I felt ashamed that I had written something not specifically focused on the actual people who were so close to the people who were lost. But then I thought, well, if any of us tries to write something that's very true and not about our egotisticalness, you know, but just an ordinary person in a not ordinary week, that I hoped it would be okay. I've always had that strong feeling that art is not an illustration of life or a message in a bottle about life, but that it's, in a metaphorical sense, each poem that we really like that someone has written is a little bit like a living being. It's not a living being, but it's a recording or a making or an embodying of a voice of one of us, whether it's autobiographical or not. It stands or falls on its own legs, kind of, rather than on the connections that it has with a life or not a life. I mean, that's just how I feel about it. I think, you know, Terry, we were talking about religion a lot. I think it has something to do, that separation, why it came to me, that I grew up thinking about these worlds, that there was earth and there was heaven and there was hell. And they were all real, and they were all simultaneous. And I don't know, I think somehow I got this idea that the jealous Calvinist God couldn't see people's poems, that art was safe from from the evil Puritan God, who, I don't know, we were his art, his sick art, and maybe our art he couldn't punish us for, or I don't. These are just like ideas in a dream.
Well, that's very interesting. Sharon Olds, thank you so much for being with us and for reading some of your work.
My pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Sharon Olds has a new collection of poems called The Unswept Room. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the Dixie Chicks' new CD. This is Fresh Air. The country music trio The Dixie Chicks has just released their first album since 1999 called Home. The Chicks are lead singer Natalie Maines, fiddler Marty McGuire, and banjo player Emily Robeson. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that the Dixie Chicks re-enter country music at a time when the tone of much of the music reflects a post-September 11th mood.
Despite their girly group name, there's a toughness to the Dixie Chicks, an implacable firmness. The lead-off track on their new album, Home, Long Time Gone, makes punning references to Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, and Hank Williams. But for the Chicks, name-checking old-school country isn't a way to score points with traditionalists or critics. It's a way of acknowledging that they couldn't pull off their glossy image, high-tech, down-home synthesis without rooting it in the earthy emotionalism of their forebears. As a result, Home already has the feel of a timeless recording, deeply exhilarating. The Dixie Chicks album arrives at a time when the biggest hit in country music is Toby Keith's Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American, a well-intentioned song in the classic country mode, straightforward patriotism that in some circles gets panned as jingoistic. Here's a bit of it.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute, we'll always recognize when we see old glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our head. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July.
In an industry where it's standard for no one to say an unkind word about any other country star, the Chicks' lead singer Natalie Maines has condemned this hit, telling the Los Angeles Daily News, quote, "I think it's ignorant." I disagree. I think it expresses the anger a lot of people feel. I believe Toby Keith's artistic sin, one the Chicks would never commit, is the cutesy use of the phrase courtesy of, which turns patriotism into a commercial. By contrast, the Chicks have produced a very intelligent album, sometimes verging on the genteel. Maine's sharp-tongued phrasing redeems a few maudlin tunes. The Chicks' harmonies on Stevie Nicks' great weepy song, Landslide, blend to approximate Nix's own artfully hoarse, modulated wail. Their pleasure in the song could not come through more vibrantly.
I took my love and I took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around. And I saw my reflection in the snow-covered hills. Well, the landslide brought me down.
While they throw down fine hoedowns on tortured, tangled heart and white trash wedding, their best moments are on tracks like Long Time Gone and A Home, performances that blend country, rock, bluegrass, and pop with a surging power that sweeps you along. The three chicks have pulled off something difficult. They've refined their trademark sound without allowing it to turn into a copyrighted formula, no courtesy of label, because they have no patience for mere courtesy. As a result, their home sounds like an entire world to be explored.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Dixie Chicks' new CD, Home. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of And Justice There Is None, a Kincaid and James detective novel by Deborah Crombie, author of A Finer End. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
British historian Charles Tripp, author of A History of Iraq. We'll talk about how Iraq became a nation, how Saddam Hussein became its strongman, and what the United States will likely face if it overthrows him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.